There are some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a large unexpected inheritance. An always-on-the-verge-of-death phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone, up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard, so you can get a new one. Just trade in any phone from our top brands on any unlimited plan. With new line on my plan. Additional terms apply for trade-in and pay off your phone offer. See Verizon.com for details.
This is Too Many Minutes, a One Hit Minute Productions podcast miniseries cracking the code of Phil Alden Robinson's 1992 tech caper, Sneakers. To decode this evergreen, era-bridging, infinitely rewatchable masterpiece, we're splitting the film into its component parts, much like its multi-generational ensemble cast for the ages. Since seeing Sneakers in cinemas all the way back in 1992, I've been trying to deconstruct the alchemy. Why does every single element harmonize so perfectly? Is it the score, the compositions, the performances, the script, the setting, the subject, the actors? After 32 years, I finally cracked it. I found Janus's little black box. The addition of each new cast member, each new voice, each new tone, what's on the page doesn't just bring them together. Rather, it becomes the framework to support what all these actors mean then and mean now to movie lovers across the decades. Phil Alden Robinson becomes a music producer as much as a director, remixing and sampling these performances, turning up the volume on their very specific music. This is a supergroup, so let's dig in and see how each bar, each sample, makes Sneakers a best of album at the jump. In episode 6, you're going to hear from author, screenwriter, and podcaster Lee Zachariah. And for the first time this series, you're going to hear from Rob Belushi and Chris Candy. That's right, co-hosts of the Too Much Movie podcast on One Hate Minute Productions, because we spoke to the poet laureate of character actors, Stephen Tobolowsky. And finally, you're going to hear from the co-writer and director of Sneakers, Phil Alden Robinson. Now, often I start the episode with a quote. We'll let the man himself do it, huh?
My voice is my passport.
Yes!
In 2013, documentarian Morgan Neville made a film called 20 Feet from Stardom, which catalogued the lives of the incredible backup singers that often evade the spotlight. In that documentary, one of the many interviewees was singer Mary Clayton. Mary, heavily pregnant, curlers in her hair, was woken up in the middle of the night to go and sing with this British band, the Rolling Somethings, according to her. It's 1969 and the Rolling Stones, late in the night, are recording Gimme Shelter. She sings alongside Mick Jagger. She does some of the verses. Everything goes well. And they ask, would you like to go in and do any part of that again? And this is what happened.
He said, you want to do another one? I said, sure, I'll do another one.
I mean, she just did it like a couple of times, you know.
So I said to myself, I'm going to do another one. I'm going to blow them out of this room.
Yeah!
Rape, murder! It's just a shadow wave! It's just a shadow wave! Rape, murder! Yeah! It's just a shadow wave! It's just a shadow wave! Rape, murder! It's
you do these things at sort of 2 a.m. and then you come in the next day and you go, bloody hell, that's good.
Yeah.
Now that is what some of the folks do in Sneakers. These backing vocalists come in and change the very alchemy of the entire film. They become sometimes the most memorable characters. So let's have a quick chat with Lee Zachariah first up, then Phil Adam Robinson, and then you can hear an ultimate highlight reel of myself, Rob Belushi, and Chris Candy talking to the legendary Stephen Tobolowsky all about filming, seeing, and revisiting Sneakers.
The supporting cast is one of the best ever. Like, you've got Donald Logue and Timothy Busfield and Eddie Jones and George Hearn and Stephen Tobolowsky and James Earl Jones in one of the greatest cameos of all time. Like, everyone is perfect. And right down to Amy Benedict, who has maybe two lines as the NSA agent at the end that Carl asks. And like 20 years after the film came out, I saw it pop up for 2 seconds in an episode of Torchwood. And I immediately went, oh, it's Mary from Sneakers. Like, you just remember all of them. They stick in your memory.
Donald Logue is so good in Sneakers that I didn't realize it was Donald Logue for 15 years. He's so good. And I'm just like, God, he's like, what a fascinating look. The hair always got me, the great white turtleneck, you know, Lee Garlington, as Elena Rishkoff, Dr. Elena Rishkoff. Those two, just everything about it. They're just like, he just looked like a regular guy, but was super smart. And yeah. It was like, not this fancy, like, you know, I don't know, more contemporary move to make like the smart scientist so super hot that everyone would thought he was hot. He's just like a regular looking dude, like semi-attractive. He's there. And then later on, it's like, oh my God, the same guy who's like with dreads and like in cornrows in Blade is that guy. Yeah. It just like blows my fucking brain away.
It's crazy. Yeah. Even today I was shocked. I was like, I know this fact. Why am I still surprised when I read?
So I want to talk about those character actors and getting them to come in. Like, was the attitude for some of these people who weren't in the central crew and weren't together for probably the length of time that the rest were? Like, was that excitement that you had all these great players, was that a huge incentive for them to be a part of the movie? Because I would imagine, like, that's what I long for in these great 90s, late 80s movies that you were a part of and that were made at this time, is they just seem to have these absolutely loaded casts, and everyone who's a bit player are now really great, phenomenal, accomplished actors who just wanted to be a part of the show. Like, I want to go play with those guys. They seem like they're going to be a blast. So did you find that with people like Donald Logue and Lee Garlington on this movie?
Definitely. And Lee, you know, as Lee said to me, she says, I get to be kissed by Robert Redford. You know, why wouldn't I want to do this? I think everybody had a sense. Certain, when Bob came on the movie, and he was really the first person we cast, it opened up the world.
Yes.
Everybody wants to be in a movie with Robert Redford. And I think Sydney was next, and then Danny, and it's like, and each one just made the whole far more attractive.
Yes.
To the point where we had our pick of just the best people, and our casting sessions were just filled with wonderful people who wanted to be in the movie. Donald, I don't think Donald had done much at that point.
No.
He's great. He's great in this. You know, he's so good. And Lee Garlington is my good luck charm. She's been in all my movies.
That's so great. That's so great. And yeah. She gets, and the interplay in that scene, the interplay with the boys, when you were saying that Strathan and Danny and River had the secret language. That's what the van is. The van that's looking down to go to Janik's office is just them getting up to mischief, and Bishop in a crisis that could literally find him in trouble or be arrested or something like that. And they're all just teasing him and taking the mickey out of him while he's in the middle of it. It is just sensational. And she plays it so perfect. She's the perfect straight man in those scenes. She's just absolutely outstanding.
You know, another sort of manifestation of the secret language. Everybody calls Bishop something different.
Yes.
You know, it's either Bish or Marty or Bishop, or River calls him Mr. Bishop.
Yes.
You know, it's like everybody has their own defined relationship with him that is manifested in how they refer to him.
Yes. And Sydney Martin. You can't. Martin. No one can do his Martin.
That's right.
So.
And I think. I could be wrong about this, but I think that was not in the script. I think they all worked that out themselves.
God. What a special crew of people you got to pull together on this.
Oh, it was wonderful. It was wonderful. Tobolowsky said to me at one point, God, this has been, could this be any better? And this is at the very end of the shoot, and I said, it could be better in one way. If the lab destroyed all the negative and we had to do it again.
This was a unique movie experience for me. My movie career had just kind of gotten started. I did like Mississippi Burning before this, which was a great role and a great movie. Did Groundhog's Day, which was going to turn out to be just classic.
Yes.
But I felt like my movie career was going up. And my agent sends me this script called Sneakers, and I was insulted. I thought, like, you know, I'm suddenly doing some sort of Disney bubblegum movie. You know, what are we doing here? And I said to my agent, listen, I thought now I'd be ready for some good projects. And now I see this script Sneakers, and they wanted me to go in and meet with Phil the next day. And they said, well, why don't you just read the script and then let us know if you want to go in? So I sat down filled with fury, and I thought, I'm going to read this awful script called Sneakers. You know, they'll probably have a talking cat in it or something, you know? A witch or something. And I'm reading this script, and I was so thoroughly chastened. I remember I said to my wife, I said, oh my God, now I know what $10 million reads like.
Yes.
And back then, $10 million would have been a lot of money. Of course, Sneakers made a lot more than that.
Yeah.
It was a huge hit. I called my agent the next day. I said, I am so sorry. I am so sorry. This is one of the greatest scripts I've ever read in my life. I said, not only take back everything I said yesterday, I am so thrilled to go in and read this part, Werner Brandes, for Phil. So I went in, and I guess I got the part, thank goodness. The next stage, I'll jump ahead, you know, so I'm reading and I'm going over it, is the table read. The first table read, I go in there, I'm sitting next to Sidney Poitier. Sitting right next to me. And there's River Phoenix. There's Robert Redford. There's Mary McDonald. There's Ben Kingsley. James Earl Jones sitting at this table. And I'm going like, did I just like die? And like I'm in kind of actor heaven? I mean, what is it? And Sidney Poitier, such a handsome man. And he was enormous. He was huge and absolutely gorgeous and such a great actor. Oh, my God. And I'm sitting at the table read, and I was so stunned. I was not, now I felt like, boy, now, oh gosh. Now I felt like I was at the beggar at the banquet. And I'm going, this is absolutely magnificent. I thought I want to look really good. Now, Werner Brandes, my first insulting thing that I felt about Werner Brandes was he only comes in on page 68. And, you know, I was at the stage in my career where I'm looking at pages and counting the number of lines. Page right. one, page two. Right. What happened to page 12? What happened? It's page 68. No, Werner Brandes. And then Werner Brandes comes out and I go like, oh, my God, what a fantastic role. So I was saying to my wife, baby, what I have to do specially for tonight, because the first scene I did was with Mary at the club.
Yes.
Where I take her out to dinner, the date. And right. I said, I think I'm going to get contact lenses because it's my chance to look good in this movie instead of with glasses. I'm going to get contact lenses.
Wow.
So, that is such a touch.
And it was such a mistake to wear contact lenses the first day of the first moment you're going to shoot something.
Oh,
I didn't realize
there was your character.
There was a break-in period. So I just said to Phil, look, got these contact lenses here. He said, just go with it, man. Just go with it. Just do what you're going to do. And he said, just do whatever you want to enchant Mary. Just do whatever you want.
Right.
And I said, okay. Now, one thing that gave me encouragement was at the time, one of my best friends ever in the world, theater friend Robert Darnell, who is no longer with us, and I don't know if Bob had passed away at this time, but his son, Matthew, always wanted to be a stuntman. So I'm showing up at this restaurant, and Matthew Darnell was the kid doing the kung fu stuff in the background, in deep background.
Wow. Yeah, on the deep, on the karate studio. That's the
karate
the
studio. That was him. He had been like a Green Beret or something in the military, but he wanted to be. So there I am with my best friend's son, and I suddenly felt this kinship. And I felt like, well, with Matt here, you know, everything's going to be great.
Great.
And we had a wonderful time doing that scene. And after that scene.
Great scene, too.
Oh my!
Great scene.
Save it. We
so many. We'll get into it. I'll get into that scene.
We can't.
So much,
so many that's, bits.
Yeah.
I'll, we can't yeah. skip like just the fact that the way your mouth's open while you're putting the lens in, she immediately sits down and you just go, okay, and you walk away straight to the buffet. Like
you go to the dim sum.
It's the greatest. Like, oh my god, look at this guy. He's gonna be so shocked at how beautiful she is, and it's such a great 180. Of like, no, he's just there for the tints.
And I was such a fan of hers.
Yes.
You know, I was such a huge fan of hers.
God.
I thought she was like, you know, so brilliant, you know, Dances with Wolves. I mean, I saw that movie so many times just to see her. And oh, what a performance. And after that scene, I don't want to jump around too much, but I'll move it ahead. After that scene, Phil said, okay, this is the deal. Mary is kind of very professional, and she's very straight-laced, and you guys are going to have several scenes together, so from now on I just want you to do whatever you can do to see if you can make her laugh. It was like a 007 thing. It was like giving me the license to kill. So it's like when we have the date in my room and I'm making dinner, we did like 43 takes. And on every take, I did something completely stupid and different. So the whole thing, like, you know, the healthiest thing in the world, bottom of a monkey cage.
Yes.
You know, bottom
That's
of a
all
monkey
you.
Cage.
That's all so, you.
Not only me, but me on one take. So
right.
like, I didn't repeat any of the stuff. So, you know, bottom of a monkey, you know, and Mary is just there because she learned the script. So she didn't know when her cue was. So she has this deer in the headlights look doing the thing like, get me out of here. And Phil was, we were on like the second floor. We were on 1.5 floors. We were in this apartment and Phil was about 10 feet down. I'd stick my head out the window and go, do another one, do another one. And so I did one. Oh, I'm going to pound these breasts if you don't mind, you know, or what, you know, I just stupid
sure.
stuff. And the dog in there, my beloved dog was the Pooch.
Oh.
And so I named the dog Pooch. You know, I should sue people for this. Pooch was my dog. And so I did have a great deal of affection for the Pooch. But for me being, I'll mention two more moments, then I'll toss it back to you guys. Two things. The gift for me about this, 2.5 things. Thing number one, Ben Kingsley.
Oh,
sure.
Ben Kingsley is the greatest storyteller in the world. He is hilarious. He is not only, and you go, Ben Kingsley, hilarious. Like in tears, hilarious. Every day when we would be in makeup, Ben Kingsley was telling stories of doing Shakespeare and everything in the countryside of England and all the terrible performances that he went through and the horrible things that happened to him. Absolutely splendid storyteller. And he kept us wrapped in the makeup room every morning we were in there. And then when he wasn't shooting, he'd take his shirt off and get in his swim trunks and lay on a kind of a chair out in the sun outside his dressing room to get that California sun. Ben Kingsley was for me the gift of that movie. One of the second gifts of that movie was James Earl Jones.
Mm.
Is that James Earl Jones, when I was a student at SMU, came to SMU and he was rehearsing the Broadway play of Mice and Men, and they were rehearsing at SMU. And so as students, we were going in watching the great James Earl Jones doing this, getting ready for Broadway. So I did that with James Earl Jones. Later on, I did Radioland Murders. And Radioland Murders, let's see, George Lucas, he was the producer of that, but he directed one of the scenes we were in. And George had invited me to his 50th birthday party, and James Earl Jones was there. And so I was able to go up and say, "You don't remember me, but when I was a junior in college," anyway, we also worked together in Thailand on a show.
Yeah.
And I was there under this airplane in the middle of the jungle with James Earl Jones. "You don't remember me. But, but when we did Sneakers," I'm saying, "James, Stephen Tobolowsky." "I don't know if you remember me from SMU." And he goes, "God, every time I see you, I just feel older and older and older." And the greatest, most hilarious moment I saw is we were shooting on the Universal set, Universal lot. And there on the Universal lot, they have tours. And so they have the shark from Jaws, and they have the coat, the car from Columbo, and the bicycle from E.T. And these little carts go through with all the tourists on it with their little snappy cameras, because they didn't have phones back then, just a little Instamatic. And the guys had their pattern going, "And right over here is Bruce, the shark from Jaws. Oh, it looks like there's Columbo's car over there." And they had this pattern that they did. Well, they called Robert Redford, James Earl Jones, and me to the set. So we're doing the bit where we're inside SeaTac, where we're inside the place and Ben Kingsley's chasing us and all that. And my dressing room is on one side of the road. James Earl Jones and Robert Redford are on the far side of the road. And they come talking to one another, walking across the road just as this cart is coming up. And it stops. And James Earl Jones and Robert Redford are walking in front of the cart, and the guy doesn't realize the two of the biggest, most famous actors in the world are crossing in front of this Universal cart, and he still does his patter. And I'm standing over on the side watching, just hearing this, "And over there is Bruce, the shark from Jaws up there. Oh, and it looks like that's Columbo's car." And I'm watching James Earl Jones and Robert Redford walk in front of that tour bus, and no one takes a picture of them. They don't even know it's them. And I realize, you know, that's the way miracles are in Hollywood. You know, they happen, and you're looking for Columbo's coat, and you miss James Earl Jones. And that's what this movie was.
Beautiful.
You played that part with so much humanity. And thinking back to when you're reading the film, right, the things about your character that are apparent from the script are the 180 IQ. I always thought my voice sounded nasal and pinched. You know, the computer match that guy with her. Like, they're not the most flowery characterizations. And I always find that you so deftly play the man, and you give the fun of those qualities, but even though it's bits throughout your whole thing, like, it's a very grounded performance where you don't lean in, you don't judge the character. And I guess I'm just curious, when you read all those things, how did you approach the role to bring such a recognizable human being with the foibles of intellectual arrogance, but also social blindness, you know?
Well, I think every actor basically just uses themselves. And I had a great acting teacher, Ed K. Martin, who happens to be the same acting teacher that Holly Hunter had.
Mm.
Many people you wander through this world and think, oh, I had Ed K. Martin too. And Ed K. Martin said something that stuck with me for my lifetime. And that is, when you act, you only ask two questions. What is my greatest hope and what is my greatest fear? And by looking at the script, you figure, what is your greatest hope and fear? And that creates a tightrope that all other questions come off of.
Right.
And so when you do that, you can't help but just apply yourself to whatever you know, also Stanislavski said, never bring the part down to you, always go up to the part.
Oh.
And so I always thought, like, well, with Werner Brandis, I've had plenty of time in high school where I felt like, you know, I never could get a date. And once, you know, I did get a date with the most popular girl, and it didn't work out well.
Right.
But, you know,
was her name Anne Hearn?
No. That's a whole different story. That's a whole different
kind of story for another podcast.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Yeah, we're just, I think Anne and I have been together now, what, 35 years?
Oh, bless you.
Congratulations.
Oh, my God. Bless
you. Congratulations.
You know, oh, boy. But, wow, what a road that's been. And all good. But I know, like, not to make fun of Werner, because when I was growing up in college and in high school, I know about being lonely.
Yeah. Right.
I know about, like, thinking, you know, I could be interesting to a woman, you know, if we went out to dinner. I'm not a pariah. You know, give me a chance. Just give me a chance. And but at the same time, you know, people are good at what they do a lot. You know, people who would date a lot were good at being on dates.
Mm-hmm.
And I figure Werner is not a guy who's been on dates a lot, because he has other passions because of his intellect, because of his voice recognition thing that he's been working on. Because of his genius is a cruel taskmaster, man.
Yeah.
You know, if you're a genius at something, it drives you. I was talking to a cello player who escaped the Soviet Union. He was taught by Rostropovich, and he and his wife escaped the Soviet Union. And I said, and now he's a famous cello player in symphony orchestras and soloist and all this kind of stuff. And I said, how did you learn to play the cello like you play the cello? And he said, because when I was a little boy, I could do it. And my father would wake me up at 3 a.m. and say, play your piece now. Because if you play your piece at 3 a.m, you could play it any time. Play it now. Play it. Hmm. And when you have this kind of, like Werner, like any of these kind of characters, like the intellectual characters I've played, is you realize that passion wakes you up in the middle of the night. It dominates your life. And so it doesn't matter how much you want to be like Brad Pitt. You know, you're not going to be Brad. you know, you're not going to be. And so you don't have to make fun of yourself, and you don't have to overplay it. I remember I threw in that line. My voice was kind of nasal and pinched.
Okay. Wow.
Because it wasn't written in. Mary's line was in the script. You have like such a lovely voice. But a woman did tell me, you know, she says, oh, it's so funny when you talk because your voice is so nasal and pinched. And I go, really? And you know, it hurt me so much on a real date. So I just kind of threw that in the scene there. And you know, Phil goes like, great. I always felt one of my advantages as an actor in this town in particular is, like I always used to joke with Anne about, is people don't really know where I live. And right. I don't mean where I live here, because now it's on Zoom. But people don't know where I live. You know, like a lot of people come out to L.A. and they want to be famous or they want to be rich and all that. I don't live in those two places.
Mm.
You know, that isn't what I ever wanted. And because people didn't know where I lived, they didn't know how necessarily to eliminate me or to crush me or whatever. And the thing that I like to find in roles, and like with Werner Brandis at that moment, like with the dog, that's where I live.
Yeah.
Mm. The pooch and that dog and what I created is where I live. And when the dog knocks the purse off and I go in there.
Pooch.
Oh, yeah.
And then I see this, and then it's like,
mm-hmm.
Now you're messing with where I live.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah,
you know, at that point, you know, at that point, you see where Werner Brandis isn't like a goofball, but it's like, you're one of those people who are playing me. Yes. I don't like being played. And so without being overt about it, it's where you live. If you could find where you live as a character, as a person, where you live, that's important to know.
I was thinking, like, your character is the early tech bro, you know, it's yeah. like who's going on online dating sites and going to the, you know, hot restaurant in Chinatown. It's so of now. But what was it like in, I guess, 92 is when you're filming this, or 93?
I think and I talked to Phil with this later. We bumped into each other something like 10 years after. Well, when we shot this in what, 91, something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, it was okay.
91, something like
there. 91 into 92, yeah.
So I saw Phil, I guess, a couple times right in a row. I saw him in Los Angeles. We were at a concert together. And this is, let's say, Sneakers had been out now 10 years, in the world 10 years. When we shot those scenes, I was thinking C-Tech, astronomy, and all that kind of stuff. No more secrets, and all that was kind of science fiction. Imagine a code to just beat all codes. You know, it seemed like it was a tech science fiction kind of movie. As the 10 years went by, you saw, oh, this was a fortune-telling film. I remember Jonathan Demme told me one thing that's always stuck with me, too. He says, in terms of directing, 90% is casting.
Yes.
In film directing. And it's like, Sneakers was a terrific cast. But in particular, Robert Redford, Sidney Poitier, and Mary, what those performers, and certainly Ben, but Ben's in a different position. Certainly what those three performers can do so easily, which a lot of times these movies don't have, is consequences. You feel emotional consequences. You feel the fear. You feel the idea we could fail from Robert Redford or Sidney Poitier without them doing anything. So there's something at stake. When Mary McDonnell is, you know, when Cosmo's going like, her, go out with him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, you could, and when she's caught by me, the like her cheeks blushed. You know, she's one of these actors that doesn't have to act it. She just is. She carries the real world consequences of what she's doing while the camera's rolling. And the camera sees that. And that's why Redford, so brilliant as the leading character in this, he's our perfect guide through this whole thing, because we see, even with his sense of humor, we see there's big consequences to what we're doing.
Right.
And that's one thing that sets this movie apart, is you take it seriously as it's going along. You know, it isn't just like a heist film where you go like, oh, well, eventually they'll drive too fast and bump the work of art as the film itself. I have two favorite scenes. When they first come back to the office, the CIA office, about 10 or 12 minutes into the movie or whatever it is, and it's not there.
Yes.
You know, and it's like, what? And then the Scrabble board, pulling out the Scrabble board and C-TAC astronomy or whatever, and then shuffling the letters around. And I first saw this movie, Phil screened it at the Academy and over on Wilshire. And, you know, everybody sitting in I think it was the Academy. It was either right next to the Academy. It was right on Wilshire Boulevard. And so when that scene happened with the Scrabble board and the letters coming together, no more secrets, there was this, oh, from an audience. Now, whenever you get a verbal, at a movie, that isn't just like a gut punch of a scream of somebody jumping out. But if it's an idea that stirs you to sound while you're watching a movie and you know that there's too many secrets. And the audience went, it was chilling. Those two scenes were my favorite. You know, I love them all, but I have a particular affinity for Ben Kingsley.
Yeah, Cosmo.
Cosmo, and I think something that this movie did at the time was it did indicate that there is a force that is bigger than politics.
Mm.
And you know, beforehand, yes, it was politics was always the most important thing. But when you got to this movie, you see, oh, there's this other thing that's happening that's bigger than anything, than bigger than nations.
Mm.
And it is now, today. That's one thing that's current today, is that high tech is, and the abuse of technology is,
it's all about the information.
The information.
Yeah.
You won't know who to trust.
It's just such a delightful, amazing film. And I'll tell you one thing that's always difficult is to make each character have their own voice.
Yes.
That's one hard thing for screenwriters to do, is that a lot of times the voices really kind of overlap in this. But in this movie, everybody has their own voice, and the own, always the kind, and it probably comes from Phil saying, like, to Dan Aykroyd, you know, bring in this stuff, or bring, you know, he lets everybody
right.
go in the direction that they want to go in. But it's a special movie that way.
This concludes the sixth episode of Too Many Minutes, a Sneakers podcast from One Heat Minute Productions. If you want to follow everything we're doing, go to oneheatminute.com or simply follow One Heat Minute Productions wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to support us, you can go over to patreon.com/oneheatminute, and with a small donation, you get to get a whole bunch of different bonus content, get content 6 months ahead of time, and help us formulate and have a little bit of extra scratch to formulate all the amazing series we have coming up next year. Two series so far, Roman and The Mincider. Special thank you to my guests today, the excellent Priscilla Page, the excellent Lee Zachariah, and the absolutely knowledgeable and terrific and extremely well-researched film historian, Jason Bailey. Thank you, Jason. Jason's going to be joining us and on a series next year on this very feed, so check that out. And also, of course, endless thanks go to co-writer and director of Sneakers, not only for Sneakers, but for his participation in the series, Mr. Phil Alden Robinson. Thank you, sir. Thank you all for listening. We'll catch you next week on another episode of Too Many Minutes.
At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger. And future stronger you can get started now by saving $28 or more when you join today. You in? We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need to keep stepping it up. And free fitness training to help you mix up your routine. Plus, most clubs are open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more. Just $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends February 28th. See home club for details.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.